Hi, this is Matt Welch. Welcome to the Reason Podcast, which you can and should subscribe to, rate, and review over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you encounter us in the wild. So Reason Magazine, since it began, has been interested in the magic that happens when consumers, as opposed to producers or gatekeepers or government, control the means of production. So when Reason celebrated our 50th anniversary in Los Angeles this November, we convened an eclectic panel to talk about the democratization of everything. We had columnist J.D. Tuccilli on DIY guns and other black market activities, sitcom showrunner and podcast pioneer Rob Long, as well as Reason Foundation education director Lisa Snell. I was the overcaffeinated moderator. Let's listen in.
Ridley wrote a book called The Rational Optimist, which would have fit into, which would have fit into our topic before the last session about science and such. But there was a concept in there that we ran as an excerpt of the magazine at the time called Ideas Having Sex. In his way of thinking about it, Tuccilli's already like...
I like that.
His mind's straight in the gutter. But the part of the concept was great technologies don't bring all the greatness at once. Someone invents the thing or invents the way to get to the thing. It's only after the information becomes sort of disseminated and cross-pollinated and that people themselves can have access to it, sort of the democratization of things. So the... panel that we're talking about here, our topic for the next 50 minutes sharp, is about the democratization of everything, by which I mean actually everything. I am delighted to be joined here by three people who are friends and colleagues and who have nothing in common other than that at all. Rob Long over there is one of the funniest people in the world, so I've just screwed you up. You have to make them laugh. It's not going to work out at all.
not for free.
Worked in television and new media for a long time. Lisa Snell is known to you all. She's been doing education stuff for Reason Foundation. And I've got a Tuccilli next to me. How many of you remember Jerome Tuccilli? A little raise of hands. I had the pleasure about a month ago to read It Usually Begins with Ayn Rand, which is one of the funniest damn great books. If you care about libertarian history and if you want to just laugh at every single character who is involved in libertarian history, including some of you people in this room, what a delight. And JD, his son, wrote the introduction of the 20th anniversary or the 20th
edition,
20th edition of it, which is very, very, very funny. So I'm going to start our conversation here with JD because he writes a lot for Reason about with a certain, let's say, vivacious celebration of people operating outside of the law in general. So we're talking about the democratization of everything. In this case, specifically, he wrote a piece not long ago about do-it-yourself guns and ammunition. So we live in an era now where people can, as far as I can tell, although maybe there's some news developments, 3D print their own damn gun. So JD, give us sort of a build up to how we got to this place and what it means that we can make our own weapons.
Absolutely. Well, when it comes to democracy, I think there's nothing more democratic than the ability to say no, to exercise a personal veto, and opt out of policies you don't care for. And when it comes to policies you might want to opt out of, attempts to disarm us, to take away weapons and leave us at the mercy of whatever the state might throw our way. Those are great policies to opt out of. Now, people have done this for a long time. You didn't need special technologies in the past, though the recent technologies, 3D printers, CNC, computer-controlled machinery, milling machines, drills, lathes, have made it easier. In the past, people certainly did it anyway. I remember in the 60s and 70s, one of my uncles did gunsmithing on the weekend. He actually made his own rifles as a hobby. That was something he did. He owned a farm. He'd go on his farm and he'd shoot. And this is in New Jersey. I remember New Jersey was starting to pass what became a long series of restrictive laws. And at one point, we were talking about them. And on his farm, he commented, well, they can pass all the laws they want. We'll just make our own guns. That's a worldwide attitude. Afghani gun makers have been knocking out AK-47 copies over charcoal fires for I don't know how long, probably before AKs were invented. In the Philippines, they make Pultics, DIY guns of varying sophistication, starting off with matchlocks. These days, knocking out copies of model 1911s and submachine guns. This is a worldwide phenomenon where people have been making their own guns forever. But you have new technology now. CNC machines and 3D printers, which ease the process of defying these laws and also feed into a tradition in the U.S. of DIY, which is applied to ammunition. I don't know if there's any reloaders here. I reload my own ammunition at home. Making your own ammunition is something that people have been doing since before there were cartridge weapons. Once cartridges were invented, cartridges were expensive and hard to find in much of the country. So people learned how to reload old cases, put new powder and new bullets in, and it became a hobby that millions of Americans do. I talked to Dillon Precision, which is an Arizona-based company that sells reloading equipment. And they flat out told me that while most people are interested in reducing their ammunition costs and in making custom loads, they said absolutely evading restrictions on ammunition is a secondary consideration for a lot of their customers. And as long as you stockpile those components which are hard to make yourself, mostly primers, there's absolutely a technique involved, an approach here, an effective one for evading controls on ammunition by making your own. You take that DIY tradition, you marry it with new technology, 3D printers, CNC machines, and you have a new revolution, or at least a new approach, an eased approach to evading restrictions on firearms. It's not magic. It's not Star Trek. You don't hit a button and all of a sudden there's a Glock sitting there. That would be awesome. it's not something we can do yet. However, if you download design files from the internet to a 3D printer, you're willing to wait a little bit of time, have some patience, have some skills with the 3D printer, which is a increasingly popular and widespread and useful tool for producing things as needed, and then do some fit and finish work afterwards, you absolutely now can have yourself a 3D printed, using a mid-level 3D printer, 3D printed revolver that you need to add only a roofing nail for a firing pin to and some elastic bands, and it will work. If you download the same kind of design files to a CNC machine, which is a computer-controlled, say, milling machine, lathe. Some of them are special purpose. Defense Distributed sells a ghost gunner specifically meant just to finish partially finished receivers for firearms. You can end up with a gun that's indistinguishable for something you would purchase commercially. In fact, a lot of commercial gun makers use CNC technology to make their guns. So this process, these new technologies, take the old desire to not be controlled. They take the old DIY tradition of reloaders, and they create a world in which you can manufacture guns without regard for what the law has to say on this matter. RAND Corporation, Department of Homeland Security, and governments from Australia to Europe have all commented that these new technologies, 3D printers, CNC machines, are making gun controls essentially unenforceable, and if people want to evade them, they will evade them. The guns you end up with aren't cheap. They're not as easy to acquire as just walking into a shop would be to purchase one under a permissive legal environment. However, they are guns you can make for yourselves. So if the legal environment is no longer permissive, you still have access to those firearms that the state doesn't want you to have. And that simple ability to exercise a veto, to democratize choice and disseminate power down to the individual level, rebalances balance of power between the individual and the state to a great extent, and puts the state on notice that we can't necessarily be controlled.
I like the smile that erupts on Jerry's face when he talks about being able to opt out of the state with weaponry. Lisa, actually opting out is kind of a perfect frame for a lot of what's happened in education, recent history. Can you kind of talk us through how people in beginning maybe with opting out of the system by homeschooling, but also sort of personalizing and tailoring their own education needs? Where was it 25 years ago and where is it now kind of thing?
So first of all, I'll start with the bad news. We still spend $800 billion a year on a monopoly K-12 system that has a single payer and a single provider. And that's the reality that we face. We spend a lot of money on K-12 schools that still follow kind of a standardized factory model. But the good news is really good news, because in all kinds of small ways, maybe at the margins to start, we're chipping away from that. And, you know, so, I mean, we have a lot of TED Talks, and I think JD must have wrote this one, but hack schooling makes me happy, right? Like with your son, that's what you guys do. And I'll just give three examples of how this is happening. And I'll start with the textbook publishers, because really when your kids carry home 80-pound school books for AP classes that they're never going to open because they're actually watching how to do calculus from Saul Kahn, right, on the internet, who doesn't love to hate the millions and billions, actually, of dollars that we spend on textbooks in the country and what an archaic model that is, right? And so right now, groups like Teachers Pay Teachers, which I know back in the day Reason TV did a video of them, you know, they do $100 million a year now in teachers selling curriculum to other teachers. And there's a bunch of copycat websites like that. And you have the emergence of like the million-dollar teacher, where selling, you know, some little $1.20 curriculum one page at a time to other teachers across the world, across the United States, these teachers have actually developed the best curriculum, everyone likes it, and now they're millionaires. You know, so who can't love that kind of a model in terms of the democratization of information and peer sharing? And even whole districts have done something like this. And I'll use an example from Arizona, because that seems to be where everything good in education happens, is in Arizona. Vail School District, which is a very traditional, regular public school district, maybe 15 years ago, they decided that the teachers would just hack the curriculum and they would build out an open source curriculum, and they call it Beyond Textbooks. And Calvin Baker, the superintendent there, stopped spending money on all textbooks and they built an original curriculum. Vail School District is the highest performing district in Arizona. And now other districts have actually adopted the Beyond Textbooks open source curriculum that they use. And my sister, who has four kids in Arizona because she's crazy, she actually has, her oldest son has Asperger's, and he thrived under the Beyond Textbook kind of scenario because that's how he could consume information. And so personally, you know, she always talks very positively about that curriculum. And then we have, you know, as far as college students and Amazon and, you know, kind of these traditional retailers now that will, you know, sell you even traditional textbooks at a much lower price, or you can rent it, or you can buy used copies, so that bookstores on college campuses, right, now they have to go into kind of the 7-Eleven retail market where they're actually selling snacks and other things college students want, because they can't actually make any money selling them college textbooks. So I think really the information that's key to education, you have MIT putting all of their classes online, and if you can make it through their online courses, they'll actually let you enroll in MIT once you prove that you can do the work. You have, you know, Stanford has a high school curriculum. Literally, you can go to Costco and stock your homeschooling second grade classroom in like 2 hours, because all of that stuff is available. You know, what every second grader needs to know, you look in the bibliography, you build it out from there, and you're done. So information is free in a lot of ways, in a way that it wasn't, and that has really contributed to being able to homeschool and hack. And then the second thing I would say is just this kind of example of traditional public schools doing something really differently. And Kevin Teasley, who actually used to work at the Reason Foundation, he has a set of charter schools in Indianapolis called the Greater Education Opportunity Foundation. And his model is, you know, we're high school students. He has high schools. Let's let every high school student have a bachelor's degree when they graduate from high school. Like, we're already spending the money. We'll just pay colleges around us to teach our high school students. And then after 4 years of high school, they'll graduate with a bachelor's degree, and we will have spent less money than if we did high school from scratch ourselves. So I think, you know, that's the great thing about school choice and the charter school movement and the school choice movement in private schools, is you have a lot of examples of people doing things differently. And then the third example I'll use is kind of the taking the homeschool hacking, but formalizing a little bit with the concept of micro schools. And people have been doing this for, you know, decades. Adrian Moore at Reason Foundation, you know, he was the guy in his homeschool community in Tehachapi that taught like government and how to make your own guns probably at home, I imagine, and economics. And so people that do homeschooling have bounded together and found experts in a topic for a long time. But now it's been formalized through the idea of micro schools, which grew out of Silicon Valley. And the first iteration of that was kind of like, okay, these really smart people, we're going to start our own school for 15 to 50 kids, and we're going to charge each parent like $70,000 to do that, right? Like, that's such a, like, Silicon Valley iteration of that. But now you have kind of these copycats, like Acton Academy, for example, where they have this great open source curriculum that focuses on the kid and self-actualization, and they're doing it for $10,000 to use their name and copy them, and then to get the school up and running, they're charging tuition of about $3,000, and you know, it's at a much lower price point. And so you have all these examples of these micro schools that are building out models that people can easily adopt, which wasn't true before. And finally, I'll just end with like James Tooley, who wrote a book called The Beautiful Tree. And his book talked about how basically in places where the education system was in a lot of ways a lot worse than the United States, so India and Africa, that these poorest parents basically did this micro schools concept first, where for pennies a day, right, they built their own micro schools with 10 to 50 kids in their communities, because literally the public schools, which are supported by lots of international aid, the teachers didn't come to work, like ever. Like, we think we have like a teacher absenteeism problem in the United States. In a lot of public schools in India, teachers miss 300 days of the year. Like, just no one shows up to like teach the classes. And so parents have been forced into this situation. So I think we've made huge strides and the future looks super bright in education for really just going around the traditional system and hacking the information and then hacking the services. And later on we can talk more about ESAs if there's time and how formal funding can support that.
So Rob Long is both a democratizer and a terrible gatekeeper, liberal media elitist.
Totally, yeah. I'm on the wrong panel. I'm not talking about guns or education at all. It's show business. It's like I should be at the kids' table with all the other show business people.
Rob was, until recently, the showrunner, which is weird language for boss of the Kevin Can Wait television program. But on his democratizer hat, he's also the founder of Ricochet, which is sort of a center-right kind of new media company that now is big into podcasts. So you've worn... You know, you've broken down the institutions here, and you've been the institution over here, including
the institution's a lot more lucrative. Just to let you know, there's no money in disruption. For Ricochet, we started. We thought we would do something sort of free market. You know, the internet's a swamp, and comment sections are terrible. So we charged people. We pegged our monthly membership fee to the cost of a grande latte at the flagship Starbucks in Seattle. And we said it was at $3.57. And we thought, you know, that's what we're really saying. Nobody pays $3.57 a month to type obscenities or to be anonymous. And so we had a very vibrant community and still do. But the problem with that pricing model, and pricing is going to be really what I talk about today because pricing is the most important thing. The problem with the pricing model is that Starbucks refused to raise their prices, right? So it was $3.56 like for a long time. And we had to come up with a different lie to tell. But it still works. And then we started doing the podcast the year before, as the idea was to sort of get – podcasts are cheap. They don't cost anything. And we thought we'd just do a podcast and we'd get, you know, X thousands of listeners a month, which was about five or – somewhere between 5 and 10 a month, which was a lot. And we would use that to promote the site. And that's pretty much how it worked for a couple of years until what they call now the direct to consumer, the D2C movement. Casper Mattresses. Everybody heard of Casper Mattresses or Harry's Shave or all these home food delivery services, they decided that they could legitimately ask podcast broadcasters on their podcast if they have, like, you know, I think at that point when they started, it was like 10,000 listener threshold, which is not that much. And they'd ask you to advertise, do a little old-time radio. So what we were doing, it's what podcast really is old-time radio. We'd say, hey, and take a little break here and tell you about this Casper mattress that they just sent me and how great it is. And it was so successful for those brands at launching them in an incredibly low-cost way, an incredibly effective way, because, of course, old-time radio totally worked. Remember when the DJ would say, we'll be right back, and you know, when I want pop, and he would just segue instantly into the ad? Well, that still works, and that's what we do. And at a certain point, there were enough advertisers in the D2C space, and there were enough podcasters and enough of an audience, and it happened at the right time when people, it seems obvious now, if people are time-shifting video with TiVo and DVRs, they're going to time-shift audio. And the great thing about audio is you can't watch TV when you're driving or you're commuting. Like, mostly audio is something that you can do while you're doing something else, and video is very bossy, so the addressable market's bigger. And then we discovered, actually, it's kind of a crazy business to sell people memberships to a site, because that happens very slowly because people don't like to pay for anything. However, if we can just continue as an advertising model, which is the opposite of what they're doing at Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime, we can actually make a lot of money, but we can make our payroll. And that is what the most interesting thing is that's happened, I think. The irony is that it isn't really disruption. It's just simply recreating a model that worked, folding in whatever the modern sort of sensibilities are, time shifting. People don't like the monologue shows as much anymore. The talk radio audience is sort of, they're just dying. They're 90, right? It's like the talk radio audience is so old that the Fox News viewers think that they're old. That's how old talk radio listeners are. So, but people still commute. People still go to the gym. People still take walks, walk the dog. They still do stuff on Saturdays. They want to listen to something. So for us, we sort of saw that opportunity. We didn't see that opportunity. That opportunity appeared and we just filled it. And it's being filled with a lot of different things too. I mean, I'm friends with a guy who does this show called This American Life. And they have the most successful podcast ever. It's called Serial, and they do one about every year. And it's a multi-part story they tell. It's usually a true crime story. It's riveting. It's really great. And it's old-time radio. That's all it is. And that's kind of the fun of the podcast business. And now in the TV business, you have to sort of start two premises. One is that everything is television. There are no movies anymore, just – if you see a movie, you go to a theater, congratulations, but it's not where it's supposed to be. It's eventually going to be here. And the model here is like in the 1960s, early 60s, or mid-60s, the TV movie business imploded. Nobody was going to see movies anymore. The movie audience was just disappeared. And there are a lot of reasons for this that people thought. And one of the things that people thought was that people are watching TV. They're not going to the movies. TV is going to kill movies. But that is not actually true. The problem was that the movie theaters were downtown, still downtown, and the audience had moved to the suburbs. And so what you're asking the audience to do, movie audience, is to get in the car and drive into the scary city and find a place to park and then go to the old movie theater that really hadn't been cleaned or anything since 1950 or something and go see a movie, then get back in the car and drive back out to your suburbs, right? So the screens were too far away from the people. And the minute they started building multiplexes, audiences went right back up. We had the big blockbusters in the late 60s and 70s where everyone has a weird explanation for this. It involves what the movies were like or what the audience was ready to see. All that's nonsense. That is just these are the lies that we tell ourselves in Hollywood to try to prove that we're really smart. All we did was we took the theater and we made it closer to the customer. And that's all you have to do. And now the theater is inside your pocket. And that has created an enormous amount of opportunity. Enormous amount of power on the part of the viewer for now. But everything in Hollywood reverts to mean. People always talk about technology changing Hollywood. Really? I mean, yeah, it's cheaper to make a movie, but you're still making a movie. You're still doing this weird thing where you set it all up. And I mean, making a movie, it's the last old-time industrial business there is. We still lay down railroad track. We have people who put down little railroad tracks still. There's no other business like that. And it comes to your phone either through the airwaves, which, you know, with like rabbit ears, or if it comes into your house for Apple TV, it comes either through your cable modem or it comes through your internet provider. That's just cable television. And what's on it right now is sort of this incredibly great, massive battle to the death of large media companies trying to figure out how to own a bigger piece of the 2 or 3 hours or 4 hours you give yourself every day, if you're, you know, a real watcher, to watch. And they hope that nobody ever figures out a way, which is obviously going to happen. The minute anyone ever says, no one will ever figure this out, somebody's going to figure it out, how you empower consumers, because that's the one power they don't have right now, which is the pricing power. How do you empower consumers to say, you know, I didn't watch Netflix this month, so I'm not going to pay for it this month, or I'm not going to pay for it next month. And then when I want to watch it, I'll just press a button and resubscribe. The whole point of the subscription part of the business is you will never look at your credit card statement. And you'll never, ever say, wait, $11, what was that for again? Like, and if you're Netflix, you can put on all the things you want. You can put on as many shows as you want. You can create as many movies as you want. You don't have any pricing power because you're terrified that if you just tick it up 50 cents, people are suddenly going to notice it. And you don't know what that number is. So you sort of live in fear. You're just hoping you become as big a part of their lives as possible. But the problem is that one thing Netflix has taught us is it's not that hard to do. All you need is money. Because it's just downloading an app and pressing a button, which we all can do now. So if you're Hulu, if you're Disney, just bought the remaining majority of Hulu, you're thinking to yourself, well, wait a minute, why don't we do that? We have money. And if you're Comcast, if you're any of these big companies, if you're Apple, the biggest company in the world, you're like, why don't we just do that? How hard could it possibly be? And the countervailing part of that now is that I think a lot of consumers are saying, you know what, I don't actually mind the ads so much. I thought I really hated them. I don't hate them so much because they're free and I can zip by them if I want, but I don't have to give anybody my credit card number and I don't have to like make a commitment to anybody. I can just watch or not watch, which is the old style of what we used to think of. And, you know, the movie business sold titles. I mean, nobody would buy a subscription to Warner Brothers movies. You just went to go see the movies. TV was just, you flipped around, right? When I started in television, the most terrifying thing in the world was the thumb on the remote. Right, and the movie business is better, right? Because you pay your money and then you go sit in the dark and watch the piece of crap they're going to show you. TV, you watch it and you're like, I don't like it. So I would caution everybody that's thinking that this is a democratization of the world, because the one piece that really makes it democratic is a fully empowered consumer, which has not happened yet. But there is a golden opportunity for somebody. That's the only piece of technology, I think, that will truly, truly disrupt Hollywood, is the unsubscribe button. It can't be that hard to build that, right?
Camille's working on it right now, so I can't design unsubscribe button. Let's talk about what happens, the backlash against moments of democratization. Jerry, you write a lot, and with a certain amount of glee, about the amount of the economy that is officially not part of the official economy, and how that's a reaction to overweening government to regulation or whatnot. What happens in the cat and mouse game, either within the specific case of, you know, 3D guns, but more broadly speaking, against those people, like pretty much your entire family in history, who like to operate outside of the law?
Well, it is true. I've got a little familial experience with things that are not entirely legal. Dating back to my great-grandfather, who ran a speakeasy, and that's how we established ourselves in this country. But there is a cat-and-mouse game. If we go to Europe, for instance, tax collection rates in Europe for income taxes are much lower than in the U.S., but they seem to be okay with that. And a lot of that is because the governments there have decided, and if you talk to the experts on this, Friedrich Schneider is probably the big expert on shadow economies around the world and on income tax collection rates. And what he writes about is that European governments, as long as they get their revenue, don't care that their actual compliance rate is 68 or 74% as compared to the U.S. rate, which is now at about 82%, pretty much the highest on the planet at 82%. So governments can have different attitudes toward this. The U.S. Government gets furious that they're only collecting 82%. The Belgian government is delighted that it's getting 68% because that's enough as far as they're concerned, and because further enforcement techniques would involve them basically going to war with their population and just and creating more tension between the individual and the state there, more tension than they're willing to tolerate, whereas the U.S. government seems to be okay with creating more tension. So how much compliance is enough really depends upon which culture you're in. The U.S. The U.S. government tends to think that anybody getting out from under its thumb is too much, whereas a lot of other regimes around the world are okay as long as it's not too obvious, as long as it's not too visible, and as long as the regime is given at least the occasional tug to forelock to keep officials happy. What's going to happen with the specifics of guns here, because guns are a direct challenge to the regime, I don't know. I mean, we talk about Europe is different. A lot of people say firearms ownership isn't prevalent in Europe. That's not really true. Germany has a population of about 80 million people. They have 7 million legally registered firearms in Germany. But if you actually look at the figures, according to the Small Arms Survey, there are actually about 30 million guns in Germany. Okay, 80 million Germans, 30 million guns, only 7 million of them are legal. That's a big gap between compliance and actual practice. And that is because people there aren't using those guns to fight the German government. They're kind of probably stockpiling them because they've had bad experience over the course of, say, the last century in Germany. Who knows? But they want to have those around maybe just in case. They're at least willing to stick them in the attic, stick them in a closet, and not register them or turn them in. The German government is okay with that, at least for the time being. Would the U.S. government be okay with that going forward if certain people get their policy wants? I don't know. The attitude here traditionally in economics has been different than in Europe. Would it be different on guns too? They're not going to get compliance. We know that. We already have seen that happen in New York where they tried banning or at least requiring the registration of assault weapons and they got 5% compliance. So going forward, what's going to happen when 3D printers are much easier to have, when CNC machines are in everybody's garage, and when it's obvious that banning physical objects is just over, it's done, it's not going to happen. I think that at some point, they're going to have to declare victory, go home, and just be happy the way the German government has been happy. Just ignore the problem, or if you want to call it a problem at all.
Lisa, my admittedly amateurish and anecdotal impression is that from, you know, say 25 years ago or whatever the number might be, you went from having a really minuscule number of people who were engaging in things like homeschooling, didn't really have much in the way of charter schools, wasn't sort of school choice or individualized stuff. There wasn't obviously online education. A minuscule number to a pretty sizable number, and that the trend lines are always going like this. I live in New York City, so I am in the bubble of all bubbles. I don't understand anything about the actual world and how it exists. My neighborhood voted 92.3% for Hillary Clinton. Bill de Blasio, the mayor there, he came to power in part by like threatening to crack skulls on the charter school movement. I notice sort of in anecdotal democratic politics, a lot more hostility to for-profit universities. You hear at least commentators say, not really as much politician, that, you know, we have to do something about homeschooling whenever something bad happens at a homeschool. So where are we in the kind of cat and mouse game between government and the sort of increase in school freedom that you have done so much to help foster?
Right. So, you know, we just recently did a study of Los Angeles, and we're here in Los Angeles of LA Unified, and they've lost 250,000 kids over the last 15 years, not just to charter schools, and they've actually lost more to like Arizona and Riverside County than to charter schools. But the narrative, of course, is that, you know, charter schools are responsible for the fiscal crisis in Los Angeles, and that, you know, Gavin Newsom right now in the state of California is running on a platform of basically banning all new charter schools and not letting any more, you know, be authorized because you have to be fiscally responsible. Like, they want to add a financial criteria that if it hurts the school district because they'd lose kids, that you can't open a new charter school. And I think that's where we are across the country in terms of the politics from government institutions and kind of the demographic that you're talking about in New York is, oh, you know, anything that you do that marginally allows families to exit, whether it's homeschooling or, you know, going to a micro school or a charter school or a private school choice program, you know, you're privatizing on the backs of children, and that these evil for-profit people, and similarly in higher education, right, it's painted as disadvantaged, you know, lower income families will then, you know, be prey to these private school companies. And that's kind of the narrative that you get, even though the people themselves, right, aren't acting like that in any way. And so that's where in New York City, right, success academies, right, the waiting list is thousands of people. You have people camping out and lining up anytime there's an open school choice, you know, program that has a set of seats. People, you know, will spend a week. It's like Black Friday for public schools to get into the school. And so I think the behavior of people doesn't match the rhetoric. And so that makes the people in charge of the institutions even more desperate, because the only way that they can stop it is by passing laws that ban it. But in the end, you can't ban, you know, a micro school that people private pay for, right? But you can make it harder for the most disadvantaged kids to take advantage of choice. And so that's kind of where we are. But even there, you have whole states like Arizona where they've basically gotten rid of residential assignment. Here in Los Angeles, they basically have had to get rid of residential assignment because of the competition from charter schools and other public schools. So even under these kind of constrained narratives, competition, that's a bad word to say, but that's what parents look for, is winning out, in my opinion. And so 25 years from now, I think it's going to look much, much different than these kind of old institutions with standardized schools.
Rob, newspaper industry where I used to work has well on collapsed. They went from, you know, printing money for 40 years, 25% profit margins, to, you know, every newspaper has been cut in half or by two-thirds for the most part. They had the rug pulled out from underneath them. It's sometimes when people talk about Hollywood and the effects of the internet and technology on it, they have forecasted something similar, particularly in the music business, I think, and I think there's more of a case for that. But is that day of reckoning ever going to come to Hollywood? Because we are living in a time where it feels like it's a golden age of television. There's an incredible proliferation. You still have these tentpole blockbusters. Is Hollywood ever going to get its reckoning? Or is there something intrinsic to that audiovisual media that makes it resistant to...
never get its reckoning. Hollywood's a very different thing because it's an idea. It's not a business. It's an idea of a business. It's a kind of a way of making money. It's not an actual thing. You know, you print a newspaper and you pay for everything because you have classified ads, and then the classified ads go to Craigslist for free, and then you got a real big problem. Hollywood has traditionally managed to refresh itself by suckering in other businesses into financing them for 10 or 15 or 20 years, and then those other businesses get wise and try to get out. So, you know, there were big conglomerates in the 50s doing it, and then there was a big insurance conglomerate doing it in the 60s, and then Coca-Cola for a long time, late 60s, 70s, into the 80s. Then Sony, consumer product company, electronic product company, is got in as desperately trying to get out somehow, some way. And now you have big companies that have a cash flow getting in and have deep pockets. So the truth is, Hollywood are the people making movies and TV for Netflix or for Apple or for, you know, Amazon. Those are the same people. They just have a different buyer. The idea of the business is the same. It's the entertainment business. And that's kind of where it remains. I mean, it's slightly more competitive, and I think it's, I always say, for people who work here in show business, it's great place to, great time to be here if you're, you know, an old timer, you've been around for a while, and it's a great time to be here if you're young and you don't mind living in a crappy apartment with, you know, cottage cheese ceiling somewhere in L.A. If you're in the middle, it's really hard. It's a very, very tough business to be if you're in the middle. It used to be kind of de facto that you could have a middling career in show business and still live in a nice house in Brentwood and send your kids to private school. You can't do that now. And you can see what's happening now is that there's a slight decentralization of Hollywood, that the idea of Hollywood also, there's Hollywood in Atlanta and there's Hollywood in New York and there's Hollywood up in Vancouver, and a lot of those faces are the same. A lot of those people are the same. The buyer is the same. The buyer may be headquartered in Burbank or New York or somewhere else. But Hollywood is just kind of a concept, so it's going to be okay. The only difference is going to be that there's going to be there are only two models to pay for the product. One is that you pay for the title. You say you like it, and I want the title or the brand. So I like the stuff that's on HBO, so I'm going to pay for HBO. And the other is I'm not going to pay for any of it. I'm just going to they're going to sell me a car somewhere in the middle of it, and I'm going to watch it. And the death of broadcast television is a perfect example of how people here sometimes get overheated about this stuff. Economically, if you're watching Amazon or Hulu or Netflix or HBO, you are no longer part of the addressable market for a consumer product company trying to sell a cruise or a car or even a movie, right? You're not even in the system. So the people who have those eyeballs, NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, who everybody kind of turns their nose up at, oh, those old guys are still around. When are they going to go? Well, it turns out that market gets really more valuable, right? Supply goes down, demand goes up. So you can make a whole lot of money. I started this business, I was a kid, I was 24, and I was working on Cheers, and that was Thursday nights at 9, and we'd come in on Friday morning, and the PA would have written our rating on our share up on the board the night before. It was always like a 33, 37, which was like 30 million people would watch. It was just, normal, right? I think one day it was 29, and we all freaked out. 29 million people, and we thought, oh God, what's happened? Turned out there was a power outage in Minneapolis, so they hadn't rearranged the number. But for a minute, they were like, oh my God, we're failing. And now 29, you get a 29, I mean, that's better than the Super Bowl. That's huge. But there's still a lot of profit there because you still have to sell people cars. And it's hard to sell them cars on the web. It doesn't work. And it's hard to sell them cars anywhere else. So it's some version of what the New York Times did. You find a sugar daddy in Carlos Slim, but the New York Times is doing pretty well, and they're doing pretty well because everybody else closed. I remember in 1990, seeing blue plastic bags on everybody's front steps, in Brentwood. And that was the New York Times home delivery, which they started, I think, 89 or 90, right around then. And the LA Times was like, well, we don't care. We don't care. No one's really going to read that paper. Why would you read that paper? And look what happened. And it wasn't because nobody in LA wants to know what's going on in LA. It's because the LA Times really stopped reporting what was going on in LA. The New York Times actually covered LA better than the LA Times because the LA Times was too snooty. But it does show you that when the consumer votes, sometimes they vote out what you think will be the local favorite.
Yeah, I worked at the LA Times for 2 years, and the Times at that moment, 1989, 1990, had something like 4,000 employees. It was most of any newspaper in the country. The fat in the place was incredibly apparent. And now, who knows what the number is? It's probably closer to 400 than it is, and it might even be lower than that. But so this is back when they still had the famous Times Mirror building downtown. My favorite thing to do was to go up to the sixth floor. And this is 2005, 2006. So we've already seen a bunch of shrinkages. The sixth floor used to be the corporate overlord floor. This is where they had gigantic globes and an oak desk that was this big. It was absolutely empty. It was frozen in time. All the paintings were from the terrible 1985 type of paintings, and the color schemes were all from around there. It was like watching the movie Star Chamber. You're just seeing those exact rooms. And it was always my idea, and for some reason they didn't allow me to do this, of take one of the local homeless guys from Skid Row and give him a webcam and see how long he could live up on the sixth floor of the corporate overlord floor of the LA Times before anybody in the building noticed. We have a time for a couple of questions out there. If anyone have questions for our people.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Just two questions. One, you're talking about guns. How does that work with drugs?
Actually, it's interesting. There's 3D printing is advancing now to the point of chemical printing. University of Edinburgh is one of the leaders in this. And what you do is you take precursor chemicals and you've got kind of a package.
Wait, slow down.
Sorry about that.
I'm writing this down.
You have precursor chemicals, and you feed them into a 3D printer, and you can then customize drugs based on common precursor chemicals. It's not at the point yet of being ready for the market, although the first 3D printed drug was approved for the U.S. last year.
Wow.
But this is the sort of thing that would have major implications, say, for orphan drugs or for customized dosages for specific patients. but also, of course, for the illegal drug market.
Right.
Potentially, at some point in the future, you could, with your home 3D chemical printer, print out whatever chemical compounds you might want, as long as you can get access to precursor chemicals, that would be relatively common.
Is the black market the long-established black market in marijuana still existing, and is it, in fact, a break on the taxation of newly legal marijuana states?
Absolutely. The states that have legalized marijuana have, by and large, crippled themselves with silly regulations and heavy taxes. I mean, if you're taxing a newly legal product at 20 or 25 or 30%, which let's say Oregon and Washington State are doing, you're leaving a huge opening for people who have already established networks and growing sources to continue in business illegally, because they'll be able to sell the stuff at a substantial discount to customers that they've always had, who see no reason why they should just start paying more to do it legally. So you still have enormous illegal markets, black markets continuing in Colorado, Oregon, Washington State, with politicians looking at each other and saying, I don't understand. Why won't they go to the legal market? They won't go to the legal market because it's burdened with heavy regulation. Home delivery, for instance, in Oregon. I don't know if they finally loosened that up. But for a long time, you couldn't get the stuff delivered legally. But your old dealer would still deliver it illegally. So why wouldn't you continue calling his cell phone? And that's what people did. So yes, you could still have large black markets for dope in a lot of these states where this stuff is nominally legal.
Questions from the audience here? Can't possibly be true. Camille, you have a question. Well,
third-party content sponsorship, certainly something that the New York Times has been availing themselves of, as well as other businesses like mine. Are you optimistic about that versus other content, insertion advertising?
Absolutely. No, I think that'll be a big deal. I mean, following the podcast model, if brands see a value in that, and you can really move the needle, as they say, which you could with podcasts, right? Podcast advertising really, really, really worked. There's no reason why that wouldn't happen. And there's also now, I mean, there's sort of the parallel things happening now is that it's a lot more investment and appetite and interest in short-form video. I mean, everybody makes fun of Snapchat, like, oh, Snapchat, right? But Snapchat's got about 130 million active daily users. It's a lot. And they spend about 30 minutes on Snapchat. That's a lot. We tend in the business to like have this kind of attitude about like, well, what they're dying. Like, no, that's not dying, by the way. That's actually doing pretty well. Like, I remember going to like some video store years ago, and the two guys running the video store, like these two, you know, film geeks, and some movie hit open. Like, oh my God, it only opened like $27 million. That guy must be embarrassed. I'm like, whoa, dude, what did your movie open at? Like, that's pretty good. So I have a feeling that when these two things happen, there's more capacity and more ability for me to encounter that media, and there's more interest in how we make an advertising, you know, model that fits that shorter media or whatever that is. I think it'll probably do okay. I mean, what you don't want to do is recreate the PBS model, you know, the Chubb Group of insurance company. That's nobody's doing that. Like, there's no money there. But there are these D2C, direct to consumer companies that see an opportunity to become household names.
Pandora.
Yeah, Pandora, MailChimp. Like, if you can think of it, anybody listen to podcasts, you know these names, and you haven't seen, you know, we were advertising on Ricochet Casper mattresses for 2 years, and I walked into the D train on Subway, and suddenly there was a train, and it was all Casper ads. That was their third level campaign, right? They already had sold a bunch of mattresses. We had already sold them a bunch of mattresses, or for them, I should say.
Let's break for lunch, people. It's 11:50. We kept time. We almost started on time this time. Say thank you to Rob Long, Lisa Snell, JD Tucci. Thank you for sitting and talking all morning. You have 10 minutes. 10 minutes only between now and then. Take a bathroom break, stretch your legs, go smoke marijuana.
This has been a special presentation of the Reason podcast from our 50th anniversary celebration in November. May you all go out and create your own 50th anniversary podcasts. In the meantime, please rate and review our work over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else. Thank you for listening.